Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. On a weekend in which the world observes Holocaust Remembrance Day, we're hearing from a man who couldn't possibly forget it. For nearly eight decades, 98-year-old Dan Doherty of Fairfield, California, has carried the memories of what he witnessed as a teenager with the 45th Infantry Division at the end of April 1945. When we left off, he was describing the Buchenwald-Dachau death train, originally headed for the Flossenbürg concentration camp, but rerouted to Dachau. By the time it completed that three-week journey, more than 80% of the 4,500 prisoners aboard, all but 816, had perished along the way.
That experience was what I company had come to. And then they had got there that morning and started immediately rounding up several hundred guards. Some of them had a difficult time handling their emotions. And there was a breakdown in discipline among some of the troops, officers, as well as enlisted men, during which a few dozen of the guards were killed without benefit of a trial. I never had known where we entered the camp. I was invited this last April to the 78th anniversary at Dachau, and I had an opportunity to sit down with one of their research guys, and he showed me on a plot exactly where we had entered. We had followed I Company, the same thing, and we had entered through an opening. It wasn't a gate. We didn't enter through the a main gate. It was just kind of an opening. And at that opening, Lieutenant Penny, our platoon leader, said, "Okay, guys, fan out and look for guards." Well, in retrospect, you realize how silly this was. This is 25 acres, the compound, the dock out. Yeah. And we're a platoon of maybe 20 guys. Fan out over 25 acres. Well, fan out we did. Some of the guys went to the right, and some went straight ahead, and I and a few others went to the left. We've just walked by 39 boxcars, and then we get into the turn to the left, and we come, and here's a whole bunch of corpses lying on the ground, and who's standing around looking at them? About a dozen civilian reporters. The Army knew where Dachau was, and in anticipation of the liberation, they had assembled this media group behind the lines. They've already brought them in. People are still looking for guards. I'm sorry, in retrospect, I never talked to any one of them. They were newspaper guys from all over the Allied world, Australia and South Africa and the United States. While we're there, one of our guys, I didn't see this, I was doing something else. One of these guys crawled over the corpses of the guards, cut off a finger because he wanted the SS ring for a souvenir. And what I heard was one of the guards, one of the reporters, like, "Hey, you can't do that." Well, he'd already done it. I'm telling you this because you're not supposed to shoot unarmed prisoners of war with hands over their head. So when they learned that something like that had happened at Dachau, there was an investigation. And we have the report, and the report mentions that in the coal yard there were 17 bodies and two of them had fingers missing. And I learned about 5 years ago who got the second ring. It was another sergeant in our company. But I spent my entire time around the coal yard, and just over the wall from it was the SS hospital for the SS. Mm-hmm. And I walked through that. It was all empty. I think I company went in there and just emptied it. We had guys out looking. There were all kinds of buildings. The guys had to go into all those buildings and search every room and make certain they weren't letting some guards get behind. And then it turns dark. Our platoon ends up spending the night in one of the homes that had housed one of the senior SS officers. Lovely flower gardens out in front. And inside you had upholstered furniture. much nicer than just an ordinary thing. We knew we had seen something mind-boggling, and we talked until midnight. And hearing the other guys, they'd had much different experiences from me. Some of them had gotten to the compound where the prisoners were. Others had been to the crematorium, and see, I had missed all that. And so I was bound and determined to get out there in the first thing in the morning and have a look around. Well, it turns out, I've often always wondered why we never did guard duty at Dachau that night. That's the only time we were anywhere near the front lines we didn't do guard duty. And I learned afterwards that we had gone in to relieve I Company, but then that evening, things were changed. I Company was determined was just a basket case and was unable to return to fighting. And so they brought in another company, I think L Company, to relieve them, and they relieved us. And so we didn't have to do the guard duty that night. And we're out of there before dawn the next morning to catch up, because I've learned afterwards that the other platoons of C Company, once they were relieved, hiked back to the town of Dachau and slept there that night. Why we slept in the camp, I don't know. But we had some catching up to do. That was about a mile away. And we're walking very briskly to catch up on the morning. And this is now April 30th. We're approaching Munich. And all of a sudden, we come to a picket fence. It's about 7 feet high. And if nothing had happened, we would have just walked on by. But it turned out to be the perimeter of the largest of the Dachau subcamps. It was called a lock, A-L-L-A-C-H. And all of a sudden, the prisoners realized we were the U.S. Army, and the celebration began. And there are no guards, and there are no corpses. It's a totally different experience than the day before. And the first thing we do is give them all of our K rations, give them all our cigarettes, all our candy. There was a potato cellar there, and we let them out to get the potatoes. And then our officers said, hey, you can't let them out. They had to keep them in there. They were afraid they would, if they got out, they'd start running around the whole community. And so we got the potatoes, and we threw them over the fence. And one of our guys threw a cigar over the fence. There was a darndest fight. And when that fight was over, the cigar was in shreds. So we didn't do that anymore. When we were there for maybe 2-3 hours, I talked to an older prisoner. He told me he was a physician from Warsaw. He said that because he was a doctor, he had been treated differentially, and they let him actually even be a doctor. You know, he didn't have any equipment or anything, but we were relieved after 2 or 3 hours and then resumed the march on Munich. But an interesting thing happened there. One of our sergeants befriended one of the prisoners that day who talked English. They talked for about an hour. About 3 days later, we get to Munich that day. We're approaching Munich with great apprehension. We think it's going to be another Nuremberg, or we'd had 3 guys killed. It turns out that along the way we learned that the early units of the 45th and the 42nd had that morning met very little resistance. And so we knew we just hiked right into Munich. Well, about 3 days later, this prisoner shows up in Munich. He just walks away from a lock. Uh-huh. And he wants to join C Company and fight the Germans. It's the last week of the war, but so Sergeant Bill puts a uniform on him, and for the 4 months of that summer, he functioned as a member. It was Anton Javorsky. He went all the way to France with us, almost got on the ship with us to come home, and Bill thought that, I don't, maybe we shouldn't do that. Well, the guy emigrates to America afterwards. One of Bill's guys in New York helps him find his father. His father had abandoned the family in Budapest, and he found his father and reconciled with him. Mm. He married, had a very good business, and at his wedding, they met a guy who had been a guard at a lock. He had befriended him as a prisoner. Wow. Kept in touch with him after the war and sent him an airline ticket to come to his wedding. Well, he had a very good relationship with Bill that whole time in America, just from that hour that started at Alok. And I'm still in contact with that fella's cousin. She's lives up in Portland, and she's active in the Jewish community up there, and she's still doing a lot of research on the family. Well, then on the, it's now the 30th of April, and we arrived that night right in downtown Munich, and the next morning, May 1st, it's immediately announced the 45th Division will occupy Munich. And that meant for us the war's over. We had been mad that we hadn't been given Nuremberg, although I'm glad we didn't, because Nuremberg was total rubble. Munich was in pretty good shape. And they say that for housing, you are to commandeer private homes. So we, Ben Ewing, the platoon sergeant, and I went up and knocked on the door. Very nice home, very lovely section of Munich. And Baroness von Schachter comes to the door. And Ben says, ma'am, we're going to billet troops in your home. We'll give your family one bedroom and the kitchen, and we're going to take the rest of the house. She said, okay. She spoke very good English. And we went across the street to the Steimer house. Herr Steimer, Frau Steimer come to the door with two very good-looking teenage daughters. And Ben says, one of the daughters speaks English, and Ben says, the same spiel, we're going to billet troops in your home. And the daughter translates this to her father, and her father goes, 9999. Well, I had a reunion with Ben Ewing after the war, and I said, Ben, do you remember what you said? When he said, no. And he said, no. I said, well, I was standing right there. I remember. And you said to the daughter, you explained to your father that if he's not satisfied with this arrangement, we'll take your entire house and your family can go live at Dachau. Well, of course, that ended the conversation. But that'll tell you the attitude that existed. We were less than 48 hours away from Dachau at that point, and nobody was about to take any gruff from the Germans. Well, how things changed. For the next month, our platoon is split up among those two in a third house. Mm-hmm. And you're living with these families. And I celebrate my 20th birthday in this, the home across, with Baroness's home. And those people baked a cake and decorated it with little American flags. Everybody got to be very chummy. And there were guys that were shacked up with women. The attraction for the women was the guys would take food home for them. Well, the first day, the Baroness came down the stairs. The Germans had to turn in their weapons, mm-hmm. handguns, rifles, shotguns. And she's carrying a beautiful 12-gauge double-barreled shotgun. And she says, Sergeant Doherty, I have to turn this in. If you'd like it, take it. So I took it and mailed it home. Well, I fired it once just to make sure it worked. It had a very unusual mechanism. But otherwise, that shotgun just stood in my closet for 50 years. And finally, in the 1990s, this is almost 50 years later, I decided I'll try to put it back in the hands of the family.
It's time for our final break, but when we come back, we'll hear how those efforts unfolded decades after World War II. If you head over to hometownheroesradio.com, you'll find photos of Dan Doherty and read some of what he's written about some very meaningful reunions with people with whom his paths crossed during the fateful final days of World War II in Europe. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. but it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.